Welcome to Chatter on Books. I'm your announcer, Jamie McIntyre. We attempted to come up with a creative introduction to the show, but our writers are on strike. Here's Tori Clark.
It's Chatter on Books, and we are at Calvert Woodley. We're not just consuming Calvert Woodley's wine and cheese. We are at Calvert Woodley at 4339 Connecticut Avenue. And we are here to have a wonderful show. Thank you very much, Michael Sands and team here at the show, for letting us crash your place at a busy time of day. People really should come here, as we say all the time.
I found parking.
Yeah, I did too. I got here extra early. I think I'm going to have to circle the neighborhood for a while, but there was parking in the parking garage. We've got a lot of stuff on tap. We've got a busy show, a quick show. At a certain point, you won't hear David's voice anymore. It's because he has to scoot early.
Just a few minutes.
We got some random thoughts, maybe some Super Bowl prop bets. Do sports journalists hate Super Bowl prop bets? Yes. Stefan is nodding his head yes. Yeah.
It depends on if you're gambling on them.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually taking part or not. Some journalists have been known to do that, by the way.
We have the books most often abandoned, and I'm very happy to see one of my favorites is on that list. We're going to talk a little bit with Michael Sands about the place and what we're eating and drinking tonight. And then our featured author, Stefan Fatsis, who you guys remember Scott Price, who said you have to have this guy on. Stefan Fatsis is with us. He is a journalist. He is an author. He's written about Scrabble. He's written about trying to be a football player in the NFL. And he's a competitive, very competitive Scrabble player teacher himself now. So we'll talk to him. But first up, a couple of randoms. And since we are kind of short on time, do we want to do Super Bowl prop bets? You know what we should do first? I have to go to you, David, first.
Go to me.
We really should talk about Kobe for a couple of minutes.
Sure.
And you and I started to talk before the show. I'm not surprised that people were stunned. I'm not surprised that so many people were saddened. So many people in the basketball world and the sports world knew him and knew what he was like. But the response to this has been way beyond just a great basketball player.
Oh, sure.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because he was, he crossed over well beyond, much like Michael Jordan did. It wasn't just that he was a great basketball player. He was just a brand. You know, Kobe was a ubiquitous American brand. That came to represent, you know, diligence and preparation and hard work and excellence and all of those things. So for people who don't know the NBA culture, you know, if you think of Michael Jordan as kind of the touchstone, or the greatest ever, right? Well, everybody who came to play in the league after Jordan's generation, that is all the players who are stars today, every single one of them, grew up idolizing Kobe Bryant, all of them. He was their Jordan, and it was his mentality, it was his intensity, it was his preparation, all of those things. It was his success, all of it. And he was very, I think, somewhat smartly able to kind of make that into an overarching beyond sports brand. So the studio that he opened a couple of years ago, which did books, ironically, books about kids and playing sports and animated features and things like that. So he was really reaching out into a whole different area. He came to embrace women's basketball very strongly.
One of its best advocates.
Yes. Yeah. Not in small part because his daughter was very good and she was starting to become an excellent basketball player. So he was just bigger than basketball in a lot of ways and reached people. And that doesn't mean that people don't understand that he was accused of an incredibly serious crime and, you know, had to pay a public price for that, if not a, you know, penal price for that. Right. But he kind of continued. His life continued. His career continued after those cases were settled and dismissed.
For which he apologized.
He did.
Not to dwell on this aspect.
But he did.
Yeah, he did.
He apologized to the young woman, and he said, I've come to understand that she may not have viewed this as consensual.
Yeah.
Which is not what I have not heard anyone else say that in a public sphere. He was just bigger than the game.
Yeah.
And he was a champion. And so people associate with champions. And that's why, I mean, we had a very good working relationship. I was not friends with the guy. I'm not going to pretend like we were friends off the court. But it hit me. It hit me hard. It
Michael,
hit everyone hard.
You were saying his career came kind of between, certainly between me and, you know, our kids didn't see him play, but they're certainly aware of him. They're in their early 20s. But what was he in your life? And you were saying Liz was pretty struck by this yesterday.
Yeah, we find out at the same time everyone else does. So it's while we're watching Torrey Pines, the final round. And my wife is a huge basketball fan, but I did not expect to see the reaction to Kobe, just as she's more of a college basketball fan. And as a young woman, there still is a past there that has a level of discomfort to it that's impossible to erase. So I was surprised by that. But I'm also of the generation where whether you're at a house party playing a drinking game, whether you are just throwing a piece of paper into a waste basket, as soon as anything leaves your hands, you're leaning back going, Kobe!
Yeah.
That speaks to this brand that really goes beyond basketball. Everything that I needed to see comes from, oddly enough, Tiger Woods, who's in the middle of his final round on the back nine, and you're sitting there wondering, how is he going to find out about this news? Because he's in La Jolla, which is not that far away, and you wonder what's trickling through the crowd. If you had someone like Steve Sands there, is that where someone's able to quietly pull you aside in between greet a tee? And they do make sure they talk to him before any camera gets up to him, which is appropriate and necessary. Sure. And Tiger Woods, for someone who is known as the ultimate competitor, someone who is known for winning, whose winning percentage is bar none, the first thing he talks about is all those qualities that David speaks to, just in terms of the preparation. For Tiger Woods to see that shows you again just how much that goes beyond basketball. And this is for someone who is in that winning period, is one of the only other few athletes who has a winning percentage that really could rival what Kobe was getting done.
And I cannot go on without saying, if you didn't watch the Grammys last night and you didn't see Alicia Keys host the Grammys, she did just a stunning job of handling a really difficult situation. As she said, they were in the Staples Center, the house that Kobe Bryant built. And she handled it with such grace. And Michael, I think you used the word decency.
Decency.
And just absolutely lovely. It turned out to be a really somber evening. What usually is one of the biggest, most raucous of the award shows turned out to be a very somber evening, but boy, she pulled it off. So she should run for president. Okay, from something really sad to really silly. So we'll do with credit to the Miami version of New Times, yes. Super Bowl prop bets. The most common ones are always the color of the Gatorade. Right? Nobody cares. But Michael, Gatorade shower will be lime green or purple?
Ooh, purple.
Okay.
It's a generational thing.
Okay. David, will J-Lo or Shakira be caught lip-syncing during their halftime show?
Shakira, of course.
Shakira, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
How many shots of A-Rod?
Exactly. During the halftime presentation.
Seriously.
That's definitely one of them.
Yeah.
And all of these, I didn't bother writing down what the Vegas odds were, because it's just changing so quickly. But how many times will they show A-Rod? Will any player propose to his girlfriend on the field after the game? Well,
if they win.
Yeah. How many times?
It's Miami. They got to go out.
These are all being bet upon as we speak. How many times will Donald Trump tweet on Super Bowl Sunday? I'm in the 30s.
Yeah, I was going to say somewhere 25-ish.
Yeah. Yeah. How many commercials will show dogs?
Oh, 20.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm going to go 10.
Yeah. And I'm going monkeys, too. Just two. Okay.
I almost did a spit take. I actually did a spit take.
If we're still doing the ridiculous, can I just highlight? I know we're going to get to the beer and wine selection here, and we all know about La Cheeserie, but it's impossible for me to not mention the official Calvert Woodley La Cheeserie t-shirt and hat. You need to be seen rocking this around
nice.
D.C.
Nice. We're going to get to the story of La Cheeserie. We're going to come to Michael here in just a minute. But I can't let the day go on without bragging about books. According to Goodreads, books that are most abandoned, and there is evidently a Japanese word for this. It's called, how do you think you pronounce that, Michael?
Schadenfreude.
Sundoku.
Sundoku.
Sundoku is the Japanese word for buying books and leaving them in a pile. There's a lot of Sundoku in my house. There's a lot of that going on.
Now, it depends on where the pile is. Is this something up front?
I love Sundoku. That's one of my favorite puzzles.
Yeah. Something you're hiding.
Anywhere. Anywhere. Okay, so, and again, this is a Goodreads list. Number one on the list, Catch-22. I read all of Catch-22.
I did not.
No one really understands it.
Yeah.
Sort of the point.
Okay. Lord of the Rings. I read all of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. That's surprising.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Ulysses. I say I read all of it. I'm not sure. David?
Yeah, I would see Ulysses and raise you Finnegan's Wake.
Number four, my favorite.
Of course, Moby Dick.
Moby Dick. Yes.
Get to the whale knots already, Tori.
We are going to make it so no one will ever read Moby Dick
again.
And then Atlas Shrugged. Yeah, I read that.
You read Atlas Shrugged?
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Michael Sands, thanks for having us here, man.
Absolutely. Thanks for being here.
It's great. It's absolutely great to be in the place where we got all the great wine and cheese. So a little backstory on you and the place. And I got a little confused. I thought you had been in this place since for over 50 years. But it's been here since 82. Your dad came here in 82?
July of 82.
But he's been in the business for well over 50 years.
Yeah, he started in 1966, about a mile down the road near the zoo.
Was into Bordeaux back then, right?
Selling Bordeaux futures with the 1966 vintage.
So speaking of, what are we drinking tonight, which is lovely?
I pick a wine every week for you guys.
Yes, you do.
Sensational.
But this time I thought, since I'm going to be here and I'll get to enjoy it, I figured I'll pick one of my very favorites. It's a Bordeaux from the Right Bank. It's Saint-Emilion, beautiful, quaint medieval village. Really, if you haven't been there, you got to go. It's incredible.
Let's talk again about Michael Sands' life and Troy Clark's life. Last week, Michael was at a Bordeaux tasting in New York in a beautiful building, and I was cleaning up garbage from my yard.
There you go.
Yeah. Go ahead. What should we be tasting in this?
I picked it also because I'm friendly with the owner. She's a wonderful woman, and she owns several properties. And this is one of the best. It's actually, this wine specifically got picked by the Wine Advocate, which is a very well respected wine journal, as their number one undervalued surprise of the year last year. So
to be tacky, how much would this cost if we had to pay for it? If I didn't slip a
using
bottle in my bag.
Yeah. Well,
that's right. Yeah, with that chatter, that Nationals 5 promo.
Well, we have the Tory Clark credit card on file, so you might want to check
you
this
do.
Tomorrow.
You
do. It's about $50.
Oh, it's really good.
It's very good.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. It's 2015 vintage, very, very good vintage, smooth and ripe and rich and a little bit earthy and a little bit...
What people say about me.
David, Michael,
fantastic.
What do you think?
Yeah, what
Mike,
really,
my empty glass shows you what I think of this wine.
Okay, so many years ago, one of my sisters dumped the most fabulous guy in the world, and then she married the worst guy in the world, who claimed to be a wine connoisseur. I don't think he really was. But one of the things he said way back then was, any red wine benefits from being allowed to breathe for a while. But you opened these so skillfully right in front of us, and we started drinking it right away. It's really good. You didn't feel the need, it didn't need to breathe?
It probably would have maybe benefited from 30 minutes, but the 2015 vintage is an excellent vintage, and it's drinking well young. It's Chateau Poesia is the name of the property. And
of course.
It's a really good wine, and it can be drunk young as opposed to a lot of Bordeaux, which need many, many years.
My in-house bartender is here. May he have a glass?
Sure.
Oh, okay, yeah. Bri, come on over. It's really good.
Was this boyfriend the type of guy who's always spinning the glass, talking about legs?
He was so awful. His name is Michael McLaughlin. And if he's still alive,
oh my goodness,
he should burn in hell.
Tory.
He is one of the very few people I ever met who, you know, they say if you get a bottle of wine in a restaurant and you don't like it, you should send it back. No one ever does that, right? He would regularly send it back.
Oh, I have a good story about that, not for air.
Just to be a snob.
Does it involve someone we know?
Yeah.
No, I wish it did. It's even closer.
My parents, deeply unhappy that she was marrying him, in a kind of a gesture, said when they were getting married, they said, Michael, since you know so much about wine, why don't you pick the wine and the champagne for the wedding? And he goes out and just buys the most expensive stuff that he can find, which I thought demonstrated he really didn't know what he was doing. But anyhow, he always said it should breathe, but this is really good. Michael, how's the cheese?
I've not tried the espresso.
They're all good.
I'm going to go to
both
that next.
Both of them.
Really good.
Both all of them.
Okay, so I'm going to stop because my mouth is full.
It's okay. It's excellent cheese. The cheese is excellent.
Michael Sands, do you know what we're having?
Lately. Is this a goat's milk?
He's the wine guy.
It is. No, he's nodding. The cheese guy is nodding.
Yeah, we got the okay.
Yeah. So
we have one of them is coated in espresso. It's the Sartori Espresso. It's got the brown ash that you can see on it. Yeah. And the other is from it's Italian. And the other is the Midnight Moon from California, Humboldt.
It's really good.
They're people that make excellent. Humboldt fog.
The espresso cheese is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yes, they're both excellent.
And I don't like coffee, and it's not coffee-like. It's actually
I don't taste any coffee at all.
So Michael Sands, born and raised in the DMV, this place is the institution of the DMV. Did you, as a little kid, you went to Merch. What did you want to be when you were a little kid? You said, I want to go drink wine and eat cheese?
I wanted to be Art Monk.
Really?
Yeah. Who didn't?
Wow. So you were a big Redskins fan?
Huge.
Oh, did you play football as a kid? If that's somebody good on your phone, you can answer.
Oh, that's my son.
Okay.
He's probably calling to cry about the Indiana game yesterday.
Oh, is he an Indiana fan?
Yeah. He goes to Indiana.
He goes to Indiana.
And he's a freshman, and I went to Indiana. So.
And it's so, that is so weird, because I'm watching that game back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Maryland pulls it out at the end, and literally, 30 seconds after the game is over, they flash this news bulletin. Well, and it was a disconnect there. Like, no, the game just ended. What are you talking about?
Couldn't have happened.
Sorry, we were here taking inventory yesterday. Excuse me. And I was trying to follow along on my phone while trying to get work done. And at the very end of the game, somebody texted me and was like, hey, Kobe Bryant just died. And I was like, no way. No. And then I'm trying to figure it out. And it took me a few minutes. And then somebody was like, oh, I can't believe Indiana lost. I'm like, what? We lost? I'm like, the game. I missed the ending because,
because you were working too hard.
Yeah, it was crazy.
What age did you realize you weren't going to be Art Monk?
Oh, I was pretty young. It was pretty young.
It happens pretty young.
I was. My two older brothers used to beat the snot out of me in the front yard, and I knew that my days of playing football
were over.
Yeah.
And how did you learn so much about everything you know about wine and cheese?
Well, to be honest, my dad never pushed any of us to be in the business. And after college, I went to work in the financial services field. And I had no interest. I had no knowledge of wine. Mm-hmm. We didn't have this in our future as, you know, a must.
Uh-huh.
So my brother is, you know, into sports, obviously. Mm-hmm. Well, we're all into sports. He's the only one getting paid to do sports.
Right.
My other brother actually works for the Washington Nationals, and I don't know, am I allowed to tell something which I don't
depends
know.
Sure.
I don't know if it's a
making
secret.
A trade of some kind?
So
for a third baseman?
My brother
came out in stereo.
Actually, goes to dynamite.
My brother actually listens to this podcast religiously, and I'm not
God
saying
bless
that.
Him. Him and two others.
I was going to say, all eight of them, huh?
Absolutely.
So,
help yourself, sir.
My brother works for the Washington Nationals. Uh-huh. He goes to every game. He works in the right field stands, and
awesome.
He works every game. And after we won, I literally, like 10 minutes after the game ended, I was like, David, you get your ring size, you know, get it all ready because you're going to get a ring.
Yeah.
He's like, get out of here. Yeah. And he just called. He called me the other night at 10:45, which means that either something really good or
really bad
happened.
Right. Yeah.
And I was a little worried. And I'm like, David, what's up? And he goes, I just wanted you to be the first person to know. I just got an email from the Lerner family that I am getting. They are giving a World Series ring to every full-time
awesome.
And part-time
that is so
employee.
Wow.
And it's going to be cool. A special ceremony, and everyone's going to get their day.
Oh, that's great.
And, that's nice.
I'm a size 10.
Really? Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. It's incredible.
Nice.
It's very exciting
that's
news
so cool.
for the Sands family.
So how do you stay on top of trends? Because this store looks very different than I'm sure it did in 1982.
It does.
A lot of beer.
A lot of beer.
We like beer.
Like beer.
Hard seltzer's growing.
Mm-hmm. Hard seltzer's growing. We have a lot of good people. Listen, as they say, it takes a village, right? And we have a wine buyer who I just saw a minute ago, Tom, who used to work at Woodley down the street with my mm-hmm. father from 80 to 82 before coming here for the last 38 years. And we have a liquor buyer who's been here forever, and we have a beer buyer, and we have a cheese buyer who's been here for over 35 years. And, my dad and I couldn't do this by ourselves, obviously. You got to have people who know what they're talking about. And
As we say all the time, and I am totally intimidated by wines, by cheeses,
absolutely.
All these things. You come in here and you say, okay, we're having six people over. We only like four of them, so let's not go crazy here. And they give you a really good bottle of wine. And then I walk over to La Cheeserie and hold up the bottle in front of them. I don't even say, and they just hold up the bottle and they pick a wonderful cheese, as they do every week almost for this show. Michael, what are the big trends for you hotshot youngsters these days?
Trends in regards to?
Drinking.
Drinking?
Yeah.
Oof. So I'm trying to develop my palate with regards to wine. I've been
historically
that's a why
beer,
you do this show.
Beer drinker. So no, I'm open to that. But I do see, I'm amazed at the growth of the seltzer category. If you see, you're going to see a ton of ads. You already saw it during the championship round. Bud Light seltzer. As soon as Bud Light enters the game, they realize that they missed the ship and they're trying to catch up ground. And it's the, you look around a store like this, and whether you're looking at the wine, the hard liquor, the sort of after dinner drinks, but just the attention to detail in the packaging and the branding that comes in that, it's, I can't imagine how you thoughtfully organize a store of this size.
Well, you asked how we get to know about, or how I got to know about wine and how we keep up with trends. You just got to taste. You got to, it's old fashioned, but you know, the best way is to taste. I started here in 98. I was 25 and I knew nothing about wine. Like literally nothing. Mm-hmm. And I have learned a lot, but I am nowhere near as knowledgeable as Tom and other people that I know in the business that have been doing this a long time. And, you know, it's just about trying. And we go, you know, I go to trade shows and like tastings in New York City.
Trade shows, Bordeaux tastings, beautiful buildings in New York.
It's a rough gig, but somebody's got to do it. But,
Your favorite? You go to visit vineyards in this place. What's your favorite place? When you look at your calendar and go, oh, I'm going there. Because you've been to some pretty spectacular vineyards. This one.
Saint-Emilion is one of my very, very favorites. This place specifically is beautiful. And I mean, Bordeaux itself is probably my favorite.
You would live there, right? Didn't you tell me once if you had to live somewhere else, that's where you would live?
I would retire there if I could make that happen. I would do it. I love Bordeaux. I've been there about 20 times.
Wow.
And I know a lot of people there, and I like, we get treated very well there, and we have a lot of friends over there, so we're very lucky. It's a beautiful place.
Cool.
The city itself, even without wine, is a beautiful place to visit. It's a really nice city. It's about the third largest city in France, so it's a big city. And,
okay, we'll get you out with this question. Hold on, before I forget. Hey, Brian, you take some pictures, please, because I always forget, and then Devin yells at me.
I would just go back to the travel. That's an aspect of this job that no one would ever think of.
Exactly.
And I'm sitting here going, it sounds amazing to go travel to Bordeaux a couple times a year and build those relationships, but that's a lot of work. And particularly when you think about, you have daughters who are 9 and 11, you have a 19-year-old son. Has that been hard to balance, just the travel and the ground legwork that has to go into building all those relationships and maintaining them? Because some of them go back to your dad.
Almost all of them go back to my dad. My dad has introduced me to almost everybody I know, and it can be hard. I mean, listen, I travel a handful of times a year. I'm not like my brother who travels to 25, 26 tournaments a year. He's all over the place. I travel, maybe 4 or 5 times. Mm-hmm. But, sure, it's hard if you take a trip to France, or you guys travel. David travels all the time.
When you
travel to the Safeway.
When you miss a weekend with your daughters, it's not always easy, but
Let's get you out with this. We'll do your version of deserted island. If you had to go to a deserted island for the rest of your life and you could only take one bottle of wine, what would you take?
Is it sustainable bottle? Like you get that bottle forever?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a bottomless bottle,
right?
But only one kind.
Right.
Is money no object? Or
no object.
Do I have to worry about money?
No, because
you're on an island.
Money's no good there.
Petrus.
Go ahead. Tell us about it.
Petrus is a wine from Bordeaux. It's on the right bank. It's not far from here, Poesia, that we're drinking tonight. It's a wine in Pomerol, and it sells for roughly $3,000 a bottle.
Hello.
Wow.
Pavlovich level.
It is. It's amazing. It's the best wine I've ever tasted.
Have you tasted it?
At the Chateau. They actually allowed me in one time, twice, and you taste it and your knees buckle. It's really, really special.
Okay, that's on our bucket list.
Absolutely.
Okay, Michael Sands, thank you so much. Thanks for being our best sponsor.
Exactly.
Only.
Brains of the outfit.
Let's take a break here, and we'll swap out Michael Sands for Stefan. Thanks, man.
This is Chatter on Books, because everyone should have a podcast. And here's your host, Victoria, or as we like to call her, Tori Clark.
It's Michael Sands' show this evening. It's Michael Sands' Chatter on Books at Calvert Woodley. It really is fun. And I love how the customers are completely unperturbed by us, and we are not getting in the way of their choices.
Looking quizzically at us.
Yeah, reaching behind Michael, grabbing a few bottles. It's great. And we're now back with Stefan Fatsis. Am I now pronouncing it correctly?
There you go.
We're in Pittsburgh. I don't pronounce anything correctly.
Yeah, sure.
Journalist, podcaster, because everybody has a podcast. Hang up and listen. Author of Word Freak, Wild and Outside.
Liquor,
line one. A few seconds of panic, and I'm going to try hard not to spend the entire time we talk with you, Stefan, about the fact that you yourself are a competitive Scrabble player and coach and entrepreneur. It's because it's a wild, wild scene. But thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
First time ever in a wine and liquor store?
No.
Come on. First time ever doing a podcast in a wine and liquor.
Yeah, definitely.
Exactly. Okay, I don't know how we divide up the time because I am obsessed, intensely interested in the whole Scrabble world.
Well, I can talk about all of them for hours, so just ask away. Wind me up.
Let's do Scrabble first.
Sure.
First, do you know Nick Lowry?
Do I know Nick Lowry? Yeah. I talked to Nick Lowry when I wrote A Few Seconds of Panic.
Right. I figured, local guy.
Yeah.
Actual local kicker from Washington who was pretty good.
Oh, nice. Talked to Mark Mosley, too.
Oh, did
none
you?
Of the, none of them made the book, but, you know. Yeah.
Okay, so the thing, my takeaway from Word Freak, the Scrabble book, is these are intensely, first of all, this is not your mother's Scrabble game.
No.
This is not at all. It's very,
pros.
Very different. These are pros and wannabe pros and all that. There are so many rules. And there are rules from
there
country
to
country.
It's a sport. There are rules. You have to account for every possible contingency, every situation.
So you're a working sports journalist. You're covering sports the way lots of people are. What got you interested in this, and what got you interested in Scrabble yourself?
It was a combination. It was like journalistic, but also my brain. I mean, I played Scrabble for fun my whole life. I was pretty good at it. I knew that there was this competitive world out there because of our mutual friend Scott Price. Uh-huh. Scott had written a piece for SI in 1995 about the subculture of competitive Scrabble. I read it, filed it away in my brain. I was getting a little bored at my job. I wanted to find something else to write about. I approached the Scrabble Association and sort of hung out and got to meet some people and realized that, no, I want to do this. I want to be one of these people. My brain is built to do this.
Tell us about that kind of brain.
It's a math brain.
Which you talk about in Word
Freak. It's the dirty little secret about Scrabble is that it's a math game, not a word game.
Were you good at math as a kid?
I was good at math as a kid. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to be a math major when I went to college. And I was disabused of that idea very quickly. But it is a brain. It is a game that is about spatial relations. It's about geometry. It is about board analysis and positions. And it's
B-O-A-R-D.
B-O-A-R-D. It's about having the flexibility in your mind to quickly unscramble and see patterns. So this is all math stuff. When you're playing at home and you're like, ooh, I made a cute word, that's not competitive Scrabble. That's living room Scrabble, as we say derisively.
And you can't see his face, but Stefan just made a completely disgusted look when he said living room Scrabble.
Yeah.
So there's a reason my smart friend Donna beats me in Words with Friends all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Just because you're a journalist,
she's
David,
way smarter than me.
You're going to suck at Scrabble, probably. And there's a reason that I got good at Scrabble. I'm sort of like bottom level expert, but there was no way I was going to become a serious challenger to be a top player.
So the book was almost an excuse to learn more about the game and get more competitive.
Well,
right?
I quickly realized that journalistically, it was like this was a fertile world. Scott was the only one that had done sort of a long piece about the world. Nobody had done a book about it. The characters were amazing. They had not been written about very much. As a writer, it's rare that you walk into a subculture that nobody has found. I mean, it's sort of like you're, you know, in the jungle and you come across some native culture that nobody has seen in 100 years.
Yeah.
And that's what it kind of was like. But as I discovered, and as I would do again in my football book, I quickly realized, and this was not an insincere gesture, but that the only way to really understand a world is to be part of it, to play it, to gain the trust of the people that were in it. I had to show that I cared. And in the case of this and in the case of kicking a football, it was natural. I wanted to do these things, and I was okay at both of them, so I was able to gain the trust of the characters that I
And you found mentors, and you found people who didn't quite take you under their wings, but they helped you a lot,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are four main characters in Word Freak, and each of them, like, tutored me and, like, let me into their lives in the way that a journalist would die to have.
How did you gain their trust?
By being, you know, a decent person who was believable. I mean, I think because you're the way you gain people's trust, and David can attest to this, is that you're sincere and you demonstrate that you care and you are professional and you're honest and you're trustworthy and you don't screw anyone over and you don't deceive them. And you mostly show that you want to be there. Mm-hmm. And there's one moment in the book very early on, like my third or fourth tournament, where one of the main characters, a guy named G.I. Joel Sherman, right. a two-time national champion and a world champion, Joel looked at me. It was like midnight. We had just played 8 games during the day in the tournament, but everyone sort of was hanging around playing more games in the evening after dinner. And he looked up at me and he said, "Are you here as a reporter or are you here because you want to be here?" And I said, "I'm here because I want to be here, man. I want to get good at this thing."
And now you teach.
I do.
You teach and you coach. Tell us about that.
Right down the street. Yeah, I've been running Scrabble clubs at elementary school and a middle school here in D.C., public schools. At my daughter, when she was when she started at Janney Elementary School, I started a club for the older kids. And then when my first group of kids moved on to middle school, I started a second club at Deal Middle School. And I've been coaching at Deal, and there's been a club at Janney ever since. I have about 20 kids in the club, and I run tournaments and take the kids to the national championship, and it's great. I love being around.
Is it like the spelling bee? And a certain person who we know doesn't really like the children who compete in the spelling bee. What are the kids like in the national Scrabble championships?
I mean, I describe competitive Scrabble as a healthier version of all of this. Uh-huh. It's not as intense. It's not like chess where there are hovering parents and this need for your child.
There aren't Scrabble moms?
Not really. No.
Nice.
No.
Nice.
And it's not the spelling bee. I feel, and I'm not a giant, I love watching the spelling bee and sort of spelling along and seeing how badly I do compared to the kids. And like every time a Scrabble word that I've studied comes up, it's like, I know that one. Awesome. But it's, to me, it's healthier in as much as the kids play 2 against 2. So you have to cooperate. It reduces some of the pressure. There's equal balance. And it's something you can do for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
It's the spelling bee, you know, it's you inhale Merriam-Webster's unabridged dictionary, and then what do you do with it? Scrabble is a life activity if you want it to be.
How many words did you learn? Words that you didn't know. How many words did you learn?
Tens of thousands.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's the strangest word you've ever used in a Scrabble game?
Oh, there are so many.
Okay, we don't know them all.
I could tell you that AA is a strange word, and you would think that, but it's like the most basic, simple word ever. I mean, I've played words, you know, Okuassa is one of my favorite words, O-Q-U-A-S-S-A. It's a fish, but I love the way it sort of flows.
Right.
It starts with a vowel, and then there's a Q in there. And vowel. I mean, there's an aesthetic to language that's very much a part of the game, and if you have that, you know, appreciation for the way letters and go together, the way that we sort of string them together to make these things that we call words that we then use to communicate with one another, it enhances the game. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, Scrabble is a very much a clinical process. Mm-hmm. It's about learning all 180,000 words that are acceptable in the Scrabble word list. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you don't have an appreciation for language and even the meanings, which you don't have to know, but if you don't have an appreciation for the language, you're really not going to want to keep going. Because at its root, it's about understanding and accepting the beauty of English and what you can do with letters.
Few things can be as far away from Scrabble as playing in the NFL. But you did that too.
Yeah.
And you immersed yourself in that as well. And a few seconds of panic. And having read this book, Stefan, I thought, well, it should be several hours of panic.
Yeah.
But the greatest line I read, and you compared it to something that you hear about the Marines, which life in the Marines is many, many hours of boredom punctuated by a few minutes of sheer terror. Mm-hmm. And that seems to summarize your experience trying to be a kicker.
Right? Totally.
Yeah. What got you thinking about this? Were you a jock wannabe when you were a kid?
I mean, like any kid, I was an okay high school athlete.
Michael Sands wannabe, Art Monk. Who did you want to be?
I wanted to be Bobby Mercer.
Yeah.
So, you know. Yeah. I mean, I was an okay high school athlete. I did not play sports in college. I never played football. I never kicked a football other than for fun. I played soccer in high school. But I'm decently coordinated, and I can play sports. So this idea was literally sitting at my desk at the time at the Wall Street Journal in the bureau here in Washington and thinking, I really want to do another book. And it just sort of, like, in one of those moments of, oh, okay, it just came into my head that nobody has done what George Plimpton did in 1963.
I couldn't believe it was that long ago.
Yeah,
1963.
Like, he wrote this book, Paper Lion. He was a quarterback for the Detroit Lions in training camp. It is a very dated book. It is very of its time, but it is an amazing piece of Americana and writing. He was an unbelievable person, and I went and when I was reporting A Few Seconds of Panic, I went and spent some time with his widow and looked at all of his papers from Paper Lion. And I just sat at my desk, and I thought, someone should redo this. And, I mean, I should redo this. But I'm also like, it said 5'8 on the cover of the hardcover of this book. I'm actually more like 5'7.
All athletes lie about that.
The NFL players do too, though, so it's okay.
Okay, but the NFL is very different when you did this than 1963.
Part of the point that, look, I couldn't be a quarterback. I would die if someone hit me. I mean, the NFL of the 2000s when I did this book and the NFL of the early 1960s are not even, they're not recognizable.
Two different
planets. They're just not the same thing. But I played soccer. I still played soccer. You know, I knew I could do this. I knew I could learn to kick. And so that was the easy part. Like, what could I do almost credibly that, like with the Scrabble, I could gain the trust of the people that were doing this for real? And the only thing that, you know, someone who's not a professional athlete could try to do is to kick. So I got a kicking coach here in Virginia, a guy named Paul Woodside, who's awesome. I had a personal trainer. I put on like 12 pounds. I became a real athlete. And that was the easy part, of course. The hard part was getting an NFL team to let me do this.
Right.
And the NFL said they'd never let you play in a game.
True.
Right? Which they are so the no-fun league.
Not in a preseason game,
How hard was it to get in shape, just to get in shape enough to even show up?
Oh, wasn't that hard. I mean, it was like I was doing two-a-days and eating six meals a day. And, like, that was a full-time job. I left the Journal after I got the book contract, after I got a team to say yes. And that took
a long time.
I mean,
lots of unanswered emails.
Not unanswered emails.
Baltimore and the Redskins.
No, I talked to Baltimore.
Yeah,
I talked.
No. I said yes, right?
So. I mean, I 20 teams.
Yeah.
You know, I met with five or six, and the Denver Broncos were very low on my list because Mike Shanahan, who of course came to coach the Redskins after he was in Denver, was not known as a particularly media friendly coach. But I knew the owner of the Broncos pretty well, the late Pat Bowlen. And Pat was the head of the TV committee. I covered the NFL for the Wall Street Journal for many years. Pat was a good source of mine, and I called him up one day and he took my call because he thought I was asking about the next round of TV negotiations. And I gave him my spiel about I want to remake Paper Lion and kick and be on the team in training camp. And I heard a pause on the line and he went, huh, that's not why I thought you were going to call. Not what you're calling about. And then he paused again and he said, I like that. Let me think about it.
Good for him.
He said, I'm going to take it up with Mike Shanahan. And if Mike's okay with it, we'll let you do it. And I hung up the phone like, oh, shit. This actually might happen. And like 2 months later, he called me back and said, let's do this. Get your ass out for training camp. Yeah. And we're going to do it.
Two things struck me reading this book. One is they took it seriously. Mike Shanahan, once they said you could do it, Mike Shanahan took it seriously. His assistant coaches took it seriously. The trainers took it. The other players took it seriously. Yeah. And then the other part, the players shared a lot with you.
They did.
I got surprising insights. And you know, you watch these guys on TV and you think they're so full of themselves. And by the time you get to the pros, you're pretty much a big stud. Right? They were scared and they got nervous and they didn't like some of the criticism. And there was one scene near the end of the book. I can't remember who it was after you're done one of the assistant coaches, and maybe he had been laid off or whatever, was stunned at what you could share with him after the book was done.
The general manager.
Yeah. And he says, I can't believe that's the way they felt. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of like Undercover Boss, you know, which is a ridiculous show. But it was a little bit like that.
Yeah. In which, Kylo Ren is the host.
Yeah, yeah. But he said, I didn't realize that. Yeah. And you just don't think that they care that much. Anyways, there was a level of caring, and there was a level and variety of emotions I never expected to hear from these guys. But I love that they took it and you so seriously.
Well, they trusted me. And again, that's, you know, I'd like to say it's some magic, like reporter magic, but it was more just me being candid with them. And I show up in this locker room. I'm this tiny guy. I'm for the first training camp. I'm sharing a 5'7". Thank you very much, David. I'm sharing a locker with another kicker. But we're like, surrounded by the offensive line, and the offensive line, one of the offensive linemen just comes and stands in front of me as I'm sitting and he's standing, and he's like, what are you doing here? And it's basically like, who the fuck are you? This little old gray haired sort of almost early 40s dude who clearly is not an NFL player. And what I did with every player was just tell them honestly, I am here so that I can understand what you go through. I don't think people get what playing in the NFL is actually like.
Yeah.
And the only way I felt like I could share that as a writer with people is for me to do what you do, or at least to try to do what you do. And it worked. And it didn't work because I was trying to trick them. It worked because I was sincere, and they could see that. And they mostly could see also, and this was important, that I was trying.
Right.
That I had, like, gotten into shape, that I had learned how to kick, that I was, you know, I wasn't threatening anyone's job, but I could actually make field goals.
Yeah, and you showed up for every practice, and sometimes you carried the equipment back.
Absolutely.
How did it feel when you first saw the jersey with your name on it?
That was pretty cool. I won't lie. Hanging in the locker with my name on top of the locker on the nameplate.
Where's the jersey now?
Awesome. The jersey is at home. I've got a home and away.
Is it framed?
Oh, you know, I haven't done the thing that athletes do and frame the jersey.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I could still do that. Yeah.
Just a matter of time.
Yeah.
So the book is fabulous. The pictures are fabulous. And when you first tried to kick the first time,
In front of the team.
Yeah, in front of the team. And there were some fans there. I guess the fans that get to come during
Broncos
preseason
summer,
and
summer
things like
camp,
that.
Mm-hmm. The Broncos, like other teams in the NFL, let fans come. There were about 1,000 to 1,500 fans there on days when fans were let in.
You speak so eloquently about pressure, but take us back. How did that feel? Because you knew you had the mechanics.
Oh, yeah.
You could do it. You knew how to do it.
And there would be, like, guys would come up to me in practice, and I'd be banging 35, 40 yarders, no problem. And the one guy said to me, I looked at you warming up, and I was like, you've got this nailed. There's no problem here. You're going to do it. And if I told you that I have never in my life felt the kind of pressure I felt in that moment when Mike Shanahan blew the whistle and said, field goal, and called me out to do it, I mean, I was utterly terrified.
Mm-hmm.
And there were stakes. He, like, if I made a field goal from whatever it was, 25 yards, which was easy for me. This was not hard. If I made a 25-yard field goal, we get 30 minutes off of practice.
The whole team gets 30 minutes off of practice.
At the end of the night.
Mm-hmm.
So that you can go home at 9:30 instead of 10 o'clock or whatever it was. I was absolutely terrified. And as one player said to me a minute after I missed the field goal by shanking it one way and then shanking another one the other way, shit the bed, Fatsis. It was utterly terrifying. But as another player came up to me right afterward, he said, now you understand. Now you know what we go through.
Yeah.
And that's why I did this, because I don't think, and I think, David, you can back this up, people don't understand.
Zero idea.
How hard it is to do what they do.
Did it change whether it was covering competitive Scrabble, and trust me, these people are very competitive, or the football? Did it change the way you operate as a journalist at all? You have more empathy?
Well, I mean, like I think a lot of people over the last decade, it's become very difficult to watch the NFL. And it became difficult for me to watch the NFL then because of what I knew they went through and what their bodies were going through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly in the last, and I did this in the summer of 2006, in the last 14 years, our awareness of the impact and the damage on NFL players' bodies and brains is higher than it was then. And it was pretty high then. It wasn't like people didn't know. But I think that the discomfort that more and more fans feel watching the NFL is much higher. And for me, it was, I mean, there's one moment standing on the sidelines during a preseason game and the pack comes toward us, a running play out of bounds, and we all run back the way you'll see people do on TV. And I think it was Mike Leach, who was the long snapper, you know, sort of like it happens. Everyone gets up, goes back on the field, and he says, yeah, it's a pretty fast game, huh? Yeah, pretty violent. Terrifying. Yeah. Terrifying.
So you, all this knowledge, what are your predictions for the Super Bowl?
Oh, I see. I don't make predictions. Do you make predictions?
No. Sucker panic.
Just because you don't want to be wrong or you don't think you should do it as part of it?
Because sports are...
ridiculous.
We have no idea. My insight and knowledge would not help anybody understand whether...
That's what's really remarkable.
Someone is going to win
and it's
lose.
One of the cool things about sports. Michael, it's true about golf, right? You can't... You can say, yes, these players should be good at these courses and these conditions, but...
Only
then
up
there's
to a certain level.
Yeah. Now... What's the greatest pressure you ever felt playing golf?
Ooh. Probably Ivy's, the first tee shot at Ivy's, just because it's such a limited field event. And that was the culmination of 4 years of trying to make the team, trying to stay on the team through injury, and then trying to crack the top five.
Yeah. I almost
wet my pants on the first tee at St. Andrews. You just don't want to embarrass yourself.
That's the widest fairway in golf.
It is true. And yet.
You've played with some pretty fancy people.
Yeah.
A president or two? Did you get nervous? You were so much better than all of them.
So a power move is showing up, not going to the driving range, and having a driving range show up on the first tee.
Nice.
Look, might have bogeyed the opening hole.
Nice. Any professional golfers?
I don't think so, actually.
Maybe some retired ones.
Retired.
Yeah, but Ivy's more pressure.
Oh, yeah.
Because the presidents suck.
Well, and then of course, Tony got accused of trying to offer me advice, which is a big no-no, and he's literally yelling at an official going, I'm an 18 handicap. Why would he ever listen to what I have to say?
If you've ever been to a professional golf tournament, you just can't imagine what it's like. I got to go to one U.S. Open and walk the course.
It's the routine comeback putts. You even saw what Tiger was dealing with on the back nine.
Just the setup alone, but then just the gallery. It's 30 deep.
Yeah.
It's 30 deep.
And they're feet away from you as you're trying to get back out of the
water. These guys just crank 300 like it's nothing. It's unbelievable.
Athletes are amazing.
Most of them, anyhow. Most of them. Okay, speaking of, and David, you got to go soon.
I'm going to go soon.
We'll do Deserted Island really quickly. And Stefan, I didn't give you your homework. I didn't give it to Michael either. But in honor of the Super Bowl, and everyone should come to Calvert Woodley for their beer, their wine, everything, their cheese. Football books.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about Paperline for a long time because I really did like that book. He was a brilliant writer. And the whole thing with Sid Finch is brilliant.
Yeah.
But
brilliant writing. I'm sorry. Brilliant writing, but not... It's very different than your book, Stefan. Very different.
No, it was clear that was kind of participatory journalism. It wasn't to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
You can't really go three rounds with Archie Moore. You know what I mean?
Like,
you just think, you just want to know what it's like to take a punch.
And I write about that in my book. I mean, and journalism changed between 1960 and 2000.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of a dilettante like Plimpton walking into a locker room today would be laughed at.
Right.
You have to do it for real. Yeah.
So, actually, I thought about it. And one of my favorite books was a book by Bill Carter, who's the writer of one of the TV writers of the New York Times, about Monday Night Football, called Monday Night Mayhem.
Huh.
And just a fantastic history of what was to me a seminal television program that I grew up watching religiously every week, because it was the first time someone had ever made a TV show an event to me, to 7-8-year-old me, right? You know, it was something like it doesn't matter who's playing, you have to watch Monday Night Football.
Big time appointment
because
television.
Howard's on and Don Meredith's on and Frank Gifford's on, you have to watch it. And they made it a show. So they as Rune Auerlich was fond of saying, they overpowered the game. It wasn't about the game. It wasn't about who won, who lost. It didn't matter. It was about the show.
Yeah.
And that was one of the first sports programs that really understood show business. And it lasted as long as it did, because sooner or later everyone gets tired of one another. But it was just great writing, great reporting, great observation. And, Cosell's a journalistic hero of mine, so I'll read anything about him. So
it's a good one. Michael Kornheiser.
It's impossible to answer this without hearing explosions in the sky, your hand and mine, in the background, if only we had rights to play that. No, I should go with something like Friday Night Lights.
Sure. That's mine.
Embarrassed to admit I have not read it, but I want to.
Another book
that's on the list is Jenkins' Semi-Tough, just because Dead Solid Perfect in Golf is my favorite book. Mm-hmm. But considering that my high school history teacher, Lynn Levinson, is here,
hello.
I'm actually asking us to zoom out and think, when we hear football, what do we think of? Because I don't think it's immediately going to our childhood heroes. I think it's seeing the varsity football players with their newly minted Letterman jackets walking down the hall. I think it's going to preseason at the dining hall when you're an undergraduate and seeing the linemen sitting together as everyone's trying to walk through a new experience. And I'm thinking about the assimilation that football represents and what it means to belong to that sort of Americana snapshot. And so I'm actually going to go in a different direction, Tori, with two small scenes. The opening scene of Catcher in the Rye finds Holden Caulfield standing at the top of the hill. In the distance, there is the homecoming game. There's a football game echoing. And in that one moment, if he just goes down the field to the rest of the team, and the team is the school here, what could we avoid? But what rift exists when he's not able to make that? And there's so much about separation and just distance as he's crossing the streets later in the city. But then another book that I'm immediately thinking of is the record scene in Goodbye Columbus, as Ron Potemkin is pulling down and playing the record for Neil, the outsider who's still stuck in close to the city, not actually the city, and what it means to enter that rarefied air. You see a family in the Potemkins who were able to make it. Mm-hmm. And what did they have to give up to make it? But there's just wonderful lines at the end of that about the echoes of, and I'm thinking of the homecoming game from Ohio State, but it's, you know, goodbye, Columbus. And Neil has that choice. Am I going to try and make the jump, leave my aunt making four dinners? Why would I make one dinner? I make four dinners. Do you want the fresh veggies? So those are two small scenes, but sports play such a large role in that novella.
I was going to do Friday Night Lights. And one of the reasons, it's like really good songs that multiple artists over the years cover, which I think is sometimes the sign, and they cover it well. It's sometimes the sign of the brilliance of something.
Yes.
Friday Night Lights, great book, great movie, great TV show. Mm-hmm. But it's a wonderful book. Stefan, so Deserted Island, Michael Sands is going to take a $3,000 bottle of wine. But if you could only take one book about football, what would it be?
Oh, God.
And of course, a few seconds of panic.
Yeah.
Which really is good.
Wow. All right, I can't do one. My football library is pretty big. I'm going to go with two pieces of fiction, A Fan's Notes by Frederick Exley, which I could read over and over again. More recent piece of fiction, Chris Batchelder's The Throwback Special, which you may not have read, is a novel that sort of begins with Joe Theismann getting tackled by Lawrence Taylor.
Ooh.
1985. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And it's a terrific, terrific book.
Okay.
And then political stuff in football. Dave Magacy's Out of My League from the early 1970s and League of Denial, because I think that we cannot be in denial anymore by the Fanaru brothers.
Mm-hmm. Good ones. Yeah. Michael Sands, you got a football book? You can say no.
No, I have a basketball book.
Okay. Well,
just shout it out. We'll repeat it. Michael Sands has a basketball book. Go ahead.
Hoosiers?
I can name many books about Bob Knight, but The Punch by John Feinstein.
Ah, The Punch by John Feinstein. Not there you go.
Okay.
My kids loved his books. Okay, Michael Sands, thank you so much for letting us be here at Calvert Woodley. It's been fabulous.
La Cheeserie.
La Cheeserie.
Actually, La Cheeserie.
David, go. Run.
I have to leave.
Go. Thank you. Love you.
Thank you.
Seven Fats is Word Freak, 23 Seconds of Panic. A few seconds of panic. It should have been a few hours of panic. That's what I keep saying. Really fabulous. People should read them. Michael Kornheiser, thank you. Claude, thanks very much. Please listen to us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you listen to us on Apple, review us nicely. We have very nice reviews, but keep them coming. We are off next week, and then we're back on February 10th, and we'll be at East City Bookshop up on Capitol Hill, where we've been before. We love them, with Jeffrey Rosen, who is a constitutional scholar, and of the many, many, many books done on RBG, it's getting a high five over there. Conversations with RBG. A really fabulous, fascinating guy, fabulous book about her. And so thanks, everybody. Go Super Bowl. And thanks again, Michael Sands. See you soon.